ABC Radio and on your pod, you're with me, Noel Debien, on The Good Life. Well, in our previous episode, Knights Templar and the intrigues of the Da Vinci Code were part of the subject, and maybe you have been fascinated by the alchemy of Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose. It was a great book and a great movie. Well, this episode of The Good Life has a little more of all that exotic mystery. No boring Catholic or Anglican stuff here. Not straightforward Islam or Buddhism here, but know the mystical Rosicrucian order for their second visit, and they claim their ideas link right back to the Cathars of the Middle Ages, back through them to the Gnostics, and back through them to ancient Egypt. Well, while the historical record can only prove their existence with absolute certainty back to sort of the 17th century, they say they are much older. They claim a remarkable secret membership of adepts, as they call them, including Leonardo da Vinci, and the occult writer and alchemist Sir Isaac Newton. And there are around 2,000 Rosicrucians presently active in Australia. Their leader is Paul Panikian here. He was born in Egypt of Armenian parents, and he migrated to Australia where he became the Grand Master of the Rosicrucian Order for Australia. He's been part of the order for over 40 years. His particular modern branch was founded formally in the USA in 1915. I asked Paul Panikian about Rosicrucian teaching in this second episode. He was clear before that Rosicrucians don't have dogma. But if they don't have dogma, what is it that they agree on?
My name is Paul Panikian. I'm the Grand Master of the Rosicrucian Order, Amok.
So when you're saying there's no dogma, but there are universal laws, what's the difference between a dogma and a universal law?
A dogma is such as in the Christian religion, where you have to accept Jesus as the Son of God. You have to believe in such and such, etc. They're the dogmas you have to accept.
So dogma is a matter of faith as opposed to something you can show?
No, dogma is a set thing which you have to accept before you become part of that religion. In the Islamic religion, you have to accept Muhammad as the last of the prophets. You have to accept the Quran as the word of God revealed to Muhammad. If you don't accept those, you're not a Muslim.
Then what is it that binds Rosicrucians to one another? What do you actually hold in common?
Ideals. Ideals are not dogmas. Ideals are things you aspire to, you want to become. Dogmas are things you have to accept.
You've mentioned karma as a universal law that the Rosicrucian is likely to be aspiring to. What other things are universal laws?
Well, actually, it's karma and reincarnation together. They are universal principles. There's the law of polarity, gender. They're universal laws which you have to understand. The law of the triangle, two points meeting for a third point to manifest. In actual fact, you don't have to have volumes of universal laws. They're just a handful. If you really understand them, you do have mastery of life.
In a sense, though, the definition of a religion is about success, isn't it? It's who wins, who becomes most numerous, and who has most influence. In contrast to that, the Rosicrucian, there's more to be said about the history, isn't there? Because you've made a connection and a claim to ancient Egypt, which is very ancient. We're going more than 3,000 years, perhaps. There is certainly a connection to the 16th century, which is absolutely provable, to the 17th century, sorry. 1611, around this time, is when the written evidence of the Rosicrucians is appearing in Lutheran Germany, so it was a Western origin as well. How do you make the connection beyond the 17th century backwards? How is that done practically?
The symbol, the Rosy Cross, the oldest that's been found is about 9th century. That's in France.
So you've got pictures of this same Rosy Cross ruin?
Yes, yes. I don't, but there is, yes. The best way to trace it is in the actual philosophy or the teachings. And you will find in modern Rosicrucian teachings and philosophies and principles a great many Gnostic ideas which are still there. So what I'm saying is, what happened is, as Christianity became more successful, Gnosticism went more underground and became persecuted. And we know from history, for instance, that the Byzantine church persecuted other Christian churches as well, not just Gnostics. For instance, the Maronites of Lebanon, they were persecuted by the Byzantines. And this went on and on for centuries. And eventually those Gnostic ideas, those Gnostic sort of things, like in the form of, say, Manichaeism, which is a very strong dualist tradition, they were persecuted out of Persia. And via Turkey, modern Turkey, and the Balkans, they eventually reached northern Italy and southern France.
St. Augustine of Hippo was a very prominent Manichae, wasn't he?
He was, before he became a Christian. So what happened was that in northern Italy and southern France, they became consolidated and known as the Cathar movement. Now, there is a very, very strong connection between the Cathars and the modern Rosicrucians in their philosophies, even in their symbology.
So you would recognize the Cathars as being, ancestors of the Rosicrucians?
As direct ancestors, yes. And also direct product from Gnostic movements.
So you're happily claiming your heretic qualifications?
Yes, that's where it comes from.
This means then, though, the Cathars were fiercely persecuted, many of them executed. And in fact, the Cathars, I think, have a link also to the Huguenots later on. There is some distant connection.
Yes, there were crusades against them organized, and they were completely obliterated. Except even now, when you go to the south of France, there is a distinct culture that's different. There's a language, again, that's different. And there's a pride in what was once a very successful culture. The Huguenots were definitely another example of the persecution mentality.
When you say the Cathars are entirely eliminated, in your view as a Rosicrucian, can you ever eliminate ideas completely?
As an organization, as an organized culture, society, they were eliminated. They were forced into becoming Catholics. No, the idea is never eliminated. No, they're still there. They're still with us. They're the ideas of the Rosicrucian order.
Now, you make a claim to the Cathars. I also recall reading somewhere that the Rosicrucians claim Isaac Newton and they claim Leonardo da Vinci. Now, these are big claims. How do you know these guys were somehow connected to the movement that you identify as consistent with yours?
It is mainly through their philosophies. In case of Newton, he was an alchemist, and that's not usually talked about. And through his alchemical researches, he was doing the work of the Rosicrucians. Leonardo is mainly known as an artist, but he was also a scientist, an inventor, and he has a lot of writings, and his philosophical writings are very Rosicrucian.
You mentioned another hot-button word, alchemist, alchemy. Now, there was a period of time when alchemy was a big thing, of course. Everybody was after the philosopher's stone. They were doing the great work. They were trying to work out how to turn base metals into gold. They were trying to find the elixir of life. In one sense, this is sort of regarded as fantastic bunkum now, and chemistry has become the valid successor to alchemy. Are you connecting yourself to the alchemical or to the chemical tradition? I'm interested.
Well, to start with, there were definitely physical alchemists, the ones who were looking to transmute, usually base metals, into gold. However, the true alchemists were using that as a symbol, as a symbology for the inner work that they were doing. And many of those true alchemists who were doing that inner work were also Rosicrucians, which is really the work. And basically, the gold stands for higher consciousness. And, of course, the base metals stand for ordinary consciousness. So it was a transmutation of consciousness. That was the real alchemy that was going on.
So you would spiritualize those who would literally interpret the changing of base metals into gold, spiritualize or mentalize that into the changing of base thoughts into higher thoughts.
Exactly, yeah. It's also known as mental alchemy, transmutation of thoughts.
How confident are you that Da Vinci's work Where does it reflect it? Where would it be easy for somebody to go and check to see for themselves?
Well, they can always read his notebooks. It gives a clue regarding his consciousness, where it was at.
And if they wanted to check up on Isaac Newton, where would they go to?
There's a lot of references to that. You know, I mean, they can always start off on the internet, but usually you'd have to go to things that are in the British Museum and that sort of thing. There's a lot on him about his alchemical side.
Now, Isaac Newton is also known, and this is factual, to have been very interested in the occult. He studied the occult. Now, how is Rosicrucianism in any way connected or interested in occult?
Well, it all depends on what we mean by the word occult, which is not in great favor these days. It simply means hidden. But a lot of the things that went on that the Rosicrucians did were known as occult in those days. And a lot of the practitioners were known as occultists. But there's two definite veins there. One is the occult, which is the more scientific approach, that is understanding laws, natural physical laws, and how to manipulate and control them, etc., which is what science does. And then there was the mystical vein, which was the transmutation of consciousness to higher consciousness. They're not in opposition. A real practitioner is one who can combine the two and balance the two.
Interesting that in one sense, what you're saying to me seems to be trying to hold together something which seems to me to have split after the Enlightenment, the quest for universal laws, which was once the realm of theology, and physics was a subset of theology, ethics was a subset of theology. All these things have now been split into their own disciplines. Science is now a discipline in its own right. Am I getting the right impression that the Rosicrucian tries to hold together all universal laws, not just science ones, not just spiritual ones, but keep them all together in some sort of universal theory?
The Rosicrucian, first of all, tries to find answers to the mysteries of life. In order to do that, he has to go to all these areas. And the outcome is what we call mastership of life. Mastery of life, being able to understand and, more importantly, live in harmony with all these things. And as Comenius in the 17th century said, the ultimate goal is happiness.
Is that what it's about? That for the Rosicrucian, this is about mastery of life, which will result in personal happiness?
Exactly.
What does it result in practically for you? If you had to look back over your own life and say, you know, Paul has achieved this by being a Rosicrucian, this is a result. Could you pinpoint things that have been results of your Rosicrucian practice for you?
I don't think it's possible to quantify, in other words, say, I ran a successful business because of the Rosicrucian teachings, or, I mean, lots of people run successful businesses, but they know nothing about the Rosicrucian teachings. So it's not a case of that, but rather, it's a case of consciousness, where your consciousness is, what sort of person are you? That is where it comes to. How humane are you? What sort of philosophy of life you've given yourself as a result of all this understanding? That's what you've got to look at.
Self-mastery is essentially the key.
Exactly. You don't have to be successful in the world. You don't have to be famous. In fact, to be really close to the source, that is the source of creation itself, you need to be humble more than anything else.